This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our own Marjorie Cohn tells us how states have responded after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in its Dobbs decision.
She'll provide us with an overview of where the states are heading, and we'll learn how California, Michigan, and Vermont are grabbing the bull by the horns to bring this issue to their voters.
We speak with attorney Deborah LaBelle, an attorney in Michigan, who has handled the litigation to guarantee the right to abortion in Michigan.
Ms. LaBelle will help us understand how the state of Michigan is taking the bull by the horns, both in the courthouse and at the ballot box. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
I am civil rights attorney Julie Hurwitz, a partner in the law firm of Goodman, Hurwitz & James, based in Detroit, Michigan, and a board member of the Michigan chapter of the National Lawyers Guild.
Since June, when the right-wing majority of the U.S. Supreme Court overruled Roe v. Wade and retracted the constitutional right to abortion, many states have enacted onerous restrictions or outright bans on the procedure. In states like California, the right to abortion has been safeguarded by legislation and judicial interpretations of that state's constitution. But if in the future Republican governors in California appoint a majority of conservative justices to the state Supreme Court, the right to abortion will be imperiled. On November 8th, voters in three states, California, Michigan, and Vermont, will decide whether to enshrine the right to abortion in their state constitutions. People in Kentucky will vote on an amendment that specifically excludes the right to abortion from constitutional protection. In August, Kansas voters rejected a similar amendment that would have explicitly said that its constitution does not provide the right to abortion. Co-host Julie Hurwitz and I interview our Law and Disorder co-host and legal scholar Marjorie Cohn about why it's crucial that states amend their constitutions to protect the right to abortion. Marjorie is professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and former president of the National Lawyers Guild. She writes a regular column at Truthout called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. Marjorie has published several books and does political and legal media commentary for local, national, and international media outlets. Marjorie, welcome to the interview chair on Law and Disorder.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here with two of my favorite co-hosts, Heidi and Julie.
Marjorie, in 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court held in Roe v. Wade that there is a fundamental right to abortion in the U.S. Constitution. On what constitutional provision did the High Court base its ruling?
In Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court said that there is a constitutional right to abortion until viability. That means until the fetus is able to live outside the womb, generally about 23 weeks of pregnancy. And the court grounded the right to abortion in the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause that protects liberty, personal liberty. The Roe Court ruled that the Due Process Clause prohibits government interference in personal decisions about contraception, marriage, procreation, familial relationships, education, and child rearing.
This past July, Marjorie, as we know, in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, five right-wing members of the Supreme Court, Alito, Thomas, Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Coney Barrett, ruled that there is no explicit or implied right to abortion in the United States Constitution. For those who don't know, who are listening, can you explain what the difference is between enumerated and unenumerated rights?
Yes, the U.S. Constitution does not specifically mention abortion as a protected right. And examples of enumerated rights, because they are enumerated or specified or listed in the Constitution, include, among others, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, and the right to a fair trial. But there are other rights that are not enumerated. They are unenumerated. They are not specifically mentioned in the Constitution, but the court has implied that they are constitutional rights, and those include the rights to travel, the right to vote, the right to use contraception, the right to engage in same-sex sexual conduct, and the right to marry someone of the same sex.
The court has specifically said that the Constitution implies. Isn't there a difference?
Yes. The court has said that although the rights that I mentioned, the rights to travel, vote, use contraception, same-sex sexual conduct, and same-sex marriage, although not specifically enumerated in the Constitution, are unenumerated or implicitly protected by the Constitution.
And Marjorie, why did the Dobbs majority hold that there is no unenumerated or implicit right to abortion in the Constitution?
Well, Samuel Alito, who wrote on behalf of himself and the other four right-wingers in the majority, said that the Constitution does not contain any reference to abortion. It is not enumerated in the Constitution. And they went on to say that there is no constitutional provision that implicitly guarantees the right to abortion. So there is no unenumerated right to abortion in the Constitution. In order to be protected by the Due Process Clause, Alito wrote, a right must be deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition and implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. And the majority concluded that there is no liberty interest because the law did not protect the right to abortion in the 19th century.
Since this ruling in Dobbs, it is now up to each state to decide whether to protect, restrict, or ban abortion. Do the constitutions of any states provide an explicit or enumerated right to abortion? Can you talk a little bit about which states do protect abortion? Also, because their courts have ruled that their constitutions implicitly protect abortion.
Well, at least 9 states provide a right to abortion in their state constitutions as interpreted by court rulings. And those states include Alaska, California, Florida, Illinois, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Montana, and New Jersey. Now, none of those states contain an explicit stated constitutional right to abortion, but the courts in those states have found an implied right to abortion by construing provisions of their constitution that protect privacy, liberty, and equality.
In your fair state of California, the right to an abortion has been protected by judicial rulings and legislation interpreting the state constitution. Can you please explain those rulings and the legislation?
Yes, abortion is legal in California before the fetus becomes viable and after viability when necessary to protect the life or health of the mother. In 1969, the California Supreme Court ruled in People versus Belus that women have the constitutional rights to life and to choose whether to bear children. And the court stated that the fundamental right of the woman to choose whether to bear children follows from the Supreme Court's and this court's repeated acknowledgement of a right to privacy or liberty in matters related to marriage, family, and sex. So that was 1969. In 1972, California voters approved Proposition 11, the Constitutional Right to Privacy Amendment, which enshrined the right to privacy as an inalienable right in the California Constitution. In 1981, the California Supreme Court held in Committee to Defend Reproductive Rights versus Myers that the protection afforded the woman's right of procreative choice as an aspect of the right of privacy under the explicit provisions of our Constitution is at least as broad as that described in Roe v. Wade. Consequently, we further conclude that the asserted state's interest in protecting a non-viable fetus is subordinate to the woman's right of privacy. In 2002, the California State Legislature declared in the Reproductive Privacy Act that women have a fundamental right to choose to bear a child or to choose to obtain an abortion. Now, as we speak, Governor Gavin Newsom of California has signed a number of measures into law that were passed by the California legislature, and they include the following. California will allow trained nurse practitioners to perform first trimester abortions without the supervision of a physician. Coroners are prohibited from holding an inquest after a fetal death. State law prohibits state law enforcement agencies from helping with out-of-state abortion investigations. And there are now liability protections for California abortion providers who care for patients traveling from areas where the procedure is banned or where access has been narrowed. And another example is eliminating out-of-pocket costs for abortions, including copays. So those are the most recent laws passed by California to protect the right to abortion.
Well, that's quite an impressive history for California. And from your historical description, it seems that abortion is safe in California. But nonetheless, there is an initiative on the November ballot that would amend its state constitution to explicitly guarantee the right to abortion. Can you explain for us what does that initiative say? And in light of this history, why do Californians think it's necessary to amend the Constitution to explicitly protect abortion?
Well, as I said, the California Supreme Court has said that abortion is implicitly protected by the state constitution via the explicit right to privacy. But a future California Supreme Court, which might have a majority of right-wingers appointed by Republican governors in California, could actually do exactly what the Supreme Court did in Dobbs, and that is to rule that there is no explicit constitutional right to abortion, and they can overrule the right to abortion in California. Therefore, the California voters will vote on November 8th whether to amend their state constitution, I should say our state constitution, since I'm a Californian, to clearly protect abortion. And Proposition 1, which is on the ballot, says the state shall not deny or interfere with an individual's reproductive freedom in their most intimate decisions, which includes their fundamental right to choose to have an abortion and their fundamental right to choose or refuse contraceptives. Proposition 1 states that the rights to abortion and contraceptives are specifically grounded in the California Constitution's right to privacy and right not to be denied equal protection. But if this Proposition 1 passes, there will be a constitutional right to abortion and right to contraception explicitly protected by the California Constitution.
And on the other side of the country, on the East Coast, Vermonters will soon decide whether to create a constitutional right to abortion. Is it currently legal in Vermont? And can you please explain what the ballot initiative says?
Yes, abortion during all stages of pregnancy is legal at the moment in Vermont. In 2019, the Vermont State Legislature enacted a law that says the state of Vermont recognizes the fundamental right of every individual who becomes pregnant to choose to carry a pregnancy to term, to give birth to a child, or to have an abortion. However, the Vermont Constitution does not explicitly guarantee the right to abortion. So on November 8th, voters in Vermont will decide whether to amend their state constitution to create a constitutional right to personal reproductive privacy that protects every person's right to make their own reproductive decisions. And if adopted, that reproductive liberty amendment would amend Article 22 of the Vermont Constitution to provide that an individual's right to personal reproductive autonomy is central to the liberty and dignity to determine one's own life course and shall not be denied or infringed unless justified by a compelling state interest achieved by the least restrictive means.
Marjorie, there is also, as we will learn more about on Wednesday, a constitutional amendment to guarantee abortion in the state of Michigan on this coming November ballot. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what this ballot amendment says and provide some background for that proposal?
The Michiganders will decide whether to amend their constitution to provide a right to reproductive freedom. And the initiative on the Michigan ballot is Proposal 3. And it says that the right to make and effectuate decisions about all matters relating to pregnancy, including but not limited to prenatal care, childbirth, postpartum care, contraception, sterilization, abortion care, miscarriage management, and infertility care, are protected under the right to productive freedom in the Michigan Constitution. That's what it would say if the voters adopt Proposal 3. And that ballot measure states that Michigan can regulate abortion after fetal viability, but cannot prohibit the use of abortion to protect the life or physical or mental health of the pregnant individual as determined by the attending healthcare professional. Proposal 3 would also prevent the state from prosecuting anyone for having an abortion or a miscarriage, or from prosecuting an individual who assists a pregnant person in exercising rights established by that amendment. In 1931, a Michigan criminal statute was passed prohibiting abortion, but it has recently been declared unconstitutional by the Michigan Court of Claims, which held that abortion is protected under the Michigan Constitution's Due Process Clause as an implied right to bodily integrity. These rulings, however, of course, are subject to appellate review. And even though there is now a Democratic majority on the Michigan Supreme Court, as with California, that could change in the future and open the door to a future Republican majority on the Michigan Supreme Court, doing exactly what the Supreme Court just did in the Dobbs case, and that is to overturn Roe v. Wade and declare that there is no right to abortion in Michigan.
Marjorie, I'm curious, what do the polls show right now about the level of support for these three constitutional amendments?
Well, they are all leading by substantial majorities. In California, there is 71% support for Proposition 1. In Michigan, there's 67% support for Proposal 3. And in Vermont, there's 70% support for amending Vermont's constitution. So they all have considerable support at this time.
We really need to work hard to get the vote out this coming November. Let's talk about some of the states that now have, if there are any that you can enlighten us on, that have ballot initiatives that would seek to outlaw abortions in their constitutions.
Yes, well, I want to start, Julie, by saying that voters in Kansas rejected a change to their constitution which would have outlawed abortion. In Kentucky, there is a measure on the November ballot that would outlaw abortion in its constitution. On August the 2nd, the Kentucky Court of Appeals reinstated a ban on abortion. And on August 18th, the Kentucky Supreme Court ordered that the abortion ban would remain in place while it reviews arguments by clinics that perform abortions, clinics which are challenging to Kentucky state laws. In 2019, the Kentucky state legislature had enacted a law prohibiting all abortions in the state in the event that the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. And that law would make performing an abortion a felony, carrying 5 years in prison. So now Kentucky voters are poised to decide whether to adopt Amendment 2, which would amend the Kentucky Constitution to say that it does not secure or protect a right to abortion. Amendment 2 reads, "Are you in favor of amending the Constitution of Kentucky by creating a new section of the Constitution to be numbered Section 26A to state as follows? To protect human life, nothing in this Constitution shall be construed to secure or protect a right to abortion or require the funding of abortion."
Marjorie, I've lost track because things are changing so quickly. How many states currently have laws banning or restricting abortion?
Nearly half the states have laws banning or severely restricting abortion. Four states, Tennessee, Alabama, West Virginia, and Louisiana, actually have constitutional amendments declaring that their constitutions do not protect the right to abortion. Arkansas has a constitutional amendment that states, "The policy of Arkansas is to protect the life of every unborn child from conception until birth to the extent permitted by the federal constitution."
Let's return to Dobbs for a moment. And Marjorie, can you help us understand how Dobbs or whether Dobbs restricts other rights, such as the right to contraception, same-sex marriage, same-sex sexual conduct, and other such what I guess would be considered unenumerated rights?
Yes. Well, in the Dobbs case, Samuel Alito wrote on behalf of himself and the other four right-wingers, "The court emphasizes that this decision concerns the constitutional right to abortion and no other right. Nothing in this opinion should be understood to cast doubt on precedents that do not concern abortion." The dissenters, however, Stephen Breyer, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan, who wrote a collective dissent, were not convinced by Alito's disclaimer. And they wrote, the dissenters wrote, "No one should be confident that this majority is done with its work." The dissent noted that the right to abortion, which is enshrined or was enshrined in Roe v. Wade, is part of the same constitutional fabric as the rights to contraception and same-sex marriage and intimacy. And then the dissenters wrote, "Either the mass of the majority's opinion is hypocrisy, or additional constitutional rights are under threat. It is one or the other." Now, Clarence Thomas, in his concurrence, specifically wrote that the court should reconsider other precedents based on the Due Process Clause, including the right to contraception, the right to same-sex sexual conduct, and the right to same-sex marriage. For some unknown reason, Thomas didn't mention the right to interracial marriage. I don't know why. But I don't think that any of those rights are secure. And it's interesting to note that in the draft opinion by Alito in the Dobbs case, which was leaked to Politico and became public months before the Supreme Court actually ruled in Dobbs, Alito was leaning toward including listing those other rights as being based on the same constitutional right to abortion. But by the time that draft opinion became a final opinion, that was omitted. And that says to me that there are at least two votes on the Supreme Court, Alito and Thomas, who would rule to outlaw rights like the right to contraception, same-sex marriage, same-sex sexual conduct. So even though Alito said this only applies to abortion, I wouldn't hold my breath on that. I think that all of the other constitutional rights may also be in jeopardy down the line.
I think that the saying, be afraid, be very afraid, is quite apropos for what we are seeing from our Supreme Court in this country.
Yes, it is. And Jeff, can we get a time check?
Marjorie, unfortunately, we've run out of our allotted time, but we'd love to thank you for your vigilance in following this topic and look forward to touching base with you after the elections to see what happened in those three states. How can our listeners follow your work?
Well, I write a weekly column on truthout.org, and it's called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. And my writings, books, articles, video interviews, radio interviews, etc., are collected on my website, marjoriecohn.com.
It's been a pleasure touching base with you on this.
Thanks so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Deborah LaBelle is a Michigan attorney and writer whose work centers on constitutional and civil rights in class actions and community representation, utilizing a human rights framework. Ms. LaBelle has been lead counsel in over a dozen class action lawsuits that have successfully expanded the civil and constitutional rights of her clients in both federal and state courts, including before the U.S. Supreme Court and in international fora. Ms. LaBelle has been the recipient of numerous awards, including the National Lawyers Guild's Law for the People Award, the National Trial Lawyer of the Year Award, the Federal Bar Association's Wade McCree Jr. Award, Michigan ACLU's Civil Libertarian of the Year Award, as well as several others just too long to list here. She is currently co-counsel with me and others on the Flint Water class action litigation, a case in which we successfully argued to the Michigan Supreme Court that our state constitution has embedded within it the fundamental due process right to bodily integrity. What brings her here today is Ms. LaBelle's most recent involvement in the historic case of Planned Parenthood versus the state of Michigan. This case was triggered by the nationwide crisis created by the recent U.S. Supreme Court reversal of Roe v. Wade in Dobbs versus Jackson. Dobbs awoke a long dormant 1931 felony statute in Michigan, which criminalizes all medical and legal actions taken to support a person who seeks or needs an abortion. This month, in the Planned Parenthood case, the Michigan Court of Claims issued a historic statewide injunction against that criminal law, holding that it violated the now recognized Michigan constitutional right to bodily integrity. While this injunction is still in effect, and inevitably on its way to being appealed, we have seen another pro-choice victory in Michigan, that is, successfully getting Proposition 3, a constitutional amendment referendum, on the statewide ballot that would explicitly recognize the constitutional right to abortion in Michigan. Deb, welcome to Law and Disorder. We are so excited to hear about your amazing work on the case and the referendum, and to help us unpack all the political and legal nuances of what is going on here in Michigan and its implications for the rest of the country.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We're so excited to hear about your amazing work on the case and the referendum, and to help our listeners unpack all the political and legal nuances of what is going on in Michigan and its implications for the rest of the country. To start with, can you explain for our listeners where things now stand with both the Planned Parenthood case and the potential passage of Proposal 3 by the people of the state of Michigan?
Well, I will definitely do my best because it's an important issue. The Planned Parenthood case, which is really Planned Parenthood and one of the doctors, Dr. Sarah Wallet, were suing on their own behalf as doctors and providers of abortions, as well as on behalf of their patients, which is a third-party standing that doctors are entitled to do. And they filed suit against the Attorney General in April of 2022. And the reason we did that was that we were prescient to begin with, but I think most of the country was after hearing the arguments in Dobbs in front of the United States Supreme Court. It seemed quite clear that the United States Supreme Court was going to pull the protections for women out that had existed for 50 years in Roe v. Wade. And so to avoid the chaos, the turmoil, the difficulties that we thought were going to happen, because the state of Michigan had not yet weighed in on whether their state constitution provided a right for reproductive freedom and abortion, we filed early, before Dobbs was even decided at the end of June, and we said Planned Parenthood asked the court to strike down a 1931 statute that made it a felony for any doctor or provider or anyone who enabled or assisted the provision of an abortion in the state of Michigan, except, with a narrow exception, to save the life of the mother. So we filed asking the court to enjoin that statute and to declare that it was unconstitutional, and to allow us to do that preliminarily and allow us to argue the case, but to keep the status quo in Michigan so that women wouldn't be in that horrible situation of not knowing whether they could go forward with their reproductive choices.
Wow. So we now know that there have been a number of other organizations that have sought to intervene in this case. Can you explain that a little bit?
I can also, I know you asked me about the ballot initiative too, but I thought it was important to get clear what was going on in the litigation. And one of the things that Planned Parenthood and the governor, who's also filed her own lawsuit in Oakland County Circuit Court, felt in this matter is that our state judges had to decide what the scope of our state constitution was. And if I can diverge a moment, what's so important about that is that we had a new constitution in Michigan in 1963, and it's a very forward-looking constitution. It talks about preserving the rights of the citizens, not just for issues that are before the court now, but looking toward the future to ensure that the citizens' equal protection and rights were secured in this state. And what the U.S. Supreme Court did in Dobbs, which was very different, is they looked back. They started going back to the 5th century and, up through the 1800s, and said, well, prior to the U.S. Constitution being enacted, were these rights that were secured and protected? And so it was important that our judges, which we elect in here in the state of Michigan, get to look at our Constitution and decide whether this right, this essential right of women to bodily integrity, to make their own decisions about their own body and reproductive choices, was secured by our Michigan Constitution, which we deeply believed it was. So that was the basis of both of the suits, both the governor and Planned Parenthood. And then people started to file amicus briefs, not intervene. The only group that intervened was the, they say they're the state legislature. They say they're the House of Representatives and the Senate. But we know that, of course, that it was a Republican Senate and Republican House that decided this. The Democrats in the House and Senate had nothing to do with deciding to intervene, and they have no voice in what's being said in these pleadings. So the legislature intervened in this case after the court granted a preliminary injunction and asked the court to overturn it, arguing that, in fact, our Constitution did not protect the freedom of choice of women, that the statute was legal and should exist and continue, and that immediately called on prosecutors to enforce the statute and began prosecuting any doctors or providers or anyone who assisted. And that could have been a very broad analysis, even as far as someone who drove someone to a clinic, for prosecutors to go forward and make arrests.
So the Court of Claims has now issued a permanent injunction on this criminal statute, and we now have this ballot initiative for amending the Constitution. Can you explain the interplay both politically and legally between the current status of the litigation and the referendum proposal 3 that's currently on the ballot?
Yes. The litigation, of course, as you noted, the Court of Claims, Judge Glaser, did issue a permanent injunction on September 7th and declared the 1931 statute unconstitutional and found that both under our Constitution that women had a bodily integrity right and a right under equal protection to abortion up to the time of viability. And so that is being appealed. The legislature has appealed it, and that will only get resolved when it gets to the Michigan Supreme Court. But meanwhile, and before that will happen, the ballot initiative set for voting on November 8th would make it very clear that there's a constitutional right, a state constitutional right to reproductive freedom, to allow women to make decisions about all matters relating to pregnancy, prenatal care, childbirth, contraception, abortion care, miscarriage management. And so that would be embedded in the Constitution. There could be no dispute about whether the Constitution provides for it or not. And that will reach the voters and be decided on before the issue gets up to the Michigan Supreme Court in the litigation.
So assuming that, for the moment, being cautiously optimistic that the ballot initiative will pass, would that render all of this pending litigation basically moot?
I think it likely would. I think that this right was so important that people concerned about it were taking every path possible, arguing first that we do believe that the Constitution should be interpreted to already include that right. However, if there is any doubt about it, and we know, for example, that in the Dobbs decision, it's very clear that a state Supreme Court or a U.S. Supreme Court can say one thing one year, as in Roe v. Wade, and a couple decades later come back and completely reverse it. So although that this, we believe that this is a right that shouldn't be subject to majority rule, that the court should declare this to be a fundamental right, it also was important that we try to enshrine it in the Constitution by a vote of the citizens so that any change in the court could not impact the decision. So the job, I think, of the litigation has been to maintain the status quo, to make abortion available for women and girls in Michigan, and also it has turned out for many of the states contiguous to Michigan, where abortion has been shut down. So Planned Parenthood has been providing services to people from Indiana, from Ohio, from a number of states in which it has become very complicated and difficult to be assured that you can exercise your choice. So the job of the litigation has been to keep every status quo until people, hopefully, also being optimistic, will vote to enshrine this in our Constitution very clearly.
This is co-host Marjorie Cohn, and we're speaking today with Deborah LaBelle, who has filed litigation in Michigan to protect the right to abortion. Deb, the criminal statute was enacted in 1931, and Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973. Didn't Roe render the old statute unconstitutional on its face? So how is it that the criminal statute has been allowed to stay on the books for the past 50 years?
In 1973, there was a lawsuit filed, actually, right before, it was before Roe v. Wade came out, and it was a prosecution of a doctor under the statute. And what the court said is, then Roe v. Wade comes out, and the court said, we're just going to put Roe v. Wade like a blanket over this statute. So to the extent that whatever Roe v. Wade says, then the statute can't be enforced up to that level. So it was quite problematic, and it was in a criminal case, so the parties really couldn't argue for the statute to be declared unconstitutional in the same way. And so what the court said is, okay, enforce it, but only up to Roe v. Wade. And so it just acted as a blanket on it. And then in 1997, there was another lawsuit filed, this by people from Detroit might remember, Councilwoman Mahaffey filed a lawsuit saying, strike it down, get it off the books, just as you suggest, it's unconstitutional. And that the Michigan state constitution provides a right for abortion. And the Court of Appeals in that case actually said, no, we're not going to strike it down because we don't find, under the argument they made, which was just a right to privacy, that Michigan's constitution has a right to privacy that encompasses the right to abortion. And so we're just going to hold it in place, the Roe v. Wade. And that actually, it didn't go up to the Michigan Supreme Court. It's just a Court of Appeals panel, a very cursory treatment of it. Just, I think, one line or two lines explaining that they didn't think privacy included a right to abortion under the state constitution. So there it has been, you know, lurking all this time and has never been declared in and of itself facially unconstitutional.
Well, here we are. So I want to shift now to what the current campaign is around the Proposition 3 initiative. The anti-choice folks, the anti-Proposition 3 ad campaigns, are already up and running and saying all kinds of things about what horrible things would come to pass if this amendment is adopted. Among other things, that all the laws governing the regulation of safe abortions in Michigan would be revoked, that all abortions would be unrestricted and unregulated, that anybody like a vet or a dentist could perform an abortion, or even anyone not licensed as a healthcare provider, that it would allow for what they refer to as disrespectful disposal of fetal remains, and it would allow the right to kill babies born alive during an abortion. Can you comment on this parade of horribles and whether we should be concerned about any or all of them?
I can say very clearly, and lawyers don't often talk very definitively about this, but none of those are true. Okay, it's an affirmative right. What would be on the ballot and what people would be voting yes to is a right to reproductive freedom, the right to make choices and decisions relating to pregnancy. And it's very clear that the state can regulate abortion after fetal viability. This is essentially reestablishing the protections we had under Roe v. Wade, and it's up to fetal viability. And then, then the state's regulations can come in, and certainly all of the other regulations in any constitutional amendment or any statute, the statute that provides an affirmative right, the only thing that falls are things that would be absolutely conflicting with that right. So, for example, they say, oh, well, it'll eliminate the obligation of minors to get parental permission. Well, it does no such thing. I mean, minors would have a right to abortion. That doesn't mean necessarily that they'll be able to obtain it in the same way. There's a process for them to obtain a parental consent or going to the courts to get a waiver. It just means you have the right. It doesn't impact in any way any of the regulations for doctors. It doesn't undercut. It doesn't somehow make a vet or a dental technician have the right to perform an abortion, nor does it get rid of all of the regulations with regard to that. There may be some parts of some regulations that would conflict with that, and that'll play out. People may challenge it. They won't automatically fall. Someone might say, well, this regulation that's been in place on, I can't even think of which one it would be, but there might be a regulation that people would say, that really does conflict with my right to make decisions about miscarriages. So, but none of this will happen as a result of this amendment, which just reestablishes our rights that we, since Roe v. Wade was decided.
Deb, would Proposal 3 allow unlimited access to abortions into late terms of pregnancy the way the anti-Proposal 3 forces are claiming?
Well, as you probably know, 93 to 95% of all abortions happen before 12 weeks. That's the way it is now. Planned Parenthood, my clients, only perform surgical abortions up to 13, 14 weeks. Others provide it up to what the Roe v. Wade viability standard is, which is 24 weeks. So what the statute does is it provides the right in consultation with a doctor to have an abortion, to make that choice up to fetal viability, which has been established by Roe v. Wade at 24 weeks for most people. So, after that, there can be no abortions unless it impacts the life or health of the mother. And that has to be done in consultation with a doctor. And doctors will not provide that kind of treatment, of course, unless it fits within both the medical regulations and care as well as the law, and the state still has regulations that will continue to apply to post-viability.
So have there been polls? What is the level of support for Proposal 3 at this point?
The only polls I've seen show an extremely strong level of support, like over 60%. I think that we saw that people were surprised in Kansas, for example, which many people thought would be more conservative than Michigan, and overwhelmingly voted to keep that right. I mean, one of the things, I just do have to say this about the parade of horribles. As women, we're not casually making decisions about this. These are important decisions. What we're rebelling against is being thought of as some kind of vessel that someone else can tell us what we can do with our bodies and our choices. You know, for many women, choice about abortion is a very extremely difficult one. Sometimes it's because it's an ectopic pregnancy. Sometimes it's because, you know, the mother's life is in extreme danger and the doctor is advising her that she won't survive a live birth. As you know, live birth, you know, there is a significant risk to going forward that doesn't exist in abortion. I think it's 28 out of 100,000 deaths. And so, you know, to think that, to say, oh, all these horrible things like you're going to choose to do this at the last moment, that's just not what happens. That's not what we do as women. We are making very personal and hard decisions about these choices. And, you know, the assumption of all of these is that somehow we're acting in bad faith with ourselves and with our choices about how to live our lives and when to have children and when not.
There are three states that are seeking to codify the right to choose in their state constitutions on the November ballot: Michigan, California, and Vermont. And New York will be following suit in the future. 15 states have a legal right to abortion, and 9 states, including Michigan, have blocked the bans against abortion. However, 14 states have either recently passed or activated dormant laws that outright ban abortions. 4 states have banned abortions after 6 to 20 weeks, and according to a recent New York Times article, at least half the states in the U.S. are expected to enact outright bans on abortions or other gestational limits in the days ahead. How do you see what is happening in Michigan impacting what we are seeing throughout the country?
So I think it can impact things in two ways. One, if we go through on the litigation and even the cases and decisions so far by Judge Gleischer is being used throughout the country for people mounting their own challenges in state courts as we speak. And it was a thoughtful, deep, and very well-done decision that's, you know, any of those kind of decisions are being used in other states to mount their own challenges, which haven't been done in all of the states yet. And then if the ballot initiative, of course, passes as we hope, I think you'll see more of those in the future as well. So I think that Michigan is, I think, you know, providing a model as to how to move forward for certain governors. The governor is providing a model on how to move forward. Not everyone has a great state Supreme Court right now, but there are states that are following in the footpaths that we've carved out in Michigan.
Well, let's hope that Michigan does lead the way to better things around the country. And thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your insights with us and for doing the work you do. And can you share with our listeners how they can follow the work that you do?
Well, I think that one thing that we haven't been at a loss for here is media coverage. So I would urge everyone to go out and vote. Not just for the ballot proposal, vote yes, but also to vote carefully for the Michigan Supreme Court justices. There were two justices on the court, Justice Zara, who's up for re-election, and Justice Viviano, who's not, who voted not just against women's right to choose, but voted not to have the right to put it on the ballot, which I think is even more significant. They didn't even want us to vote. And so, luckily, there were five other justices who said, no, it should be on the ballot proposal. Michigan should have the right to make this decision and have a right to cast their vote on it. So, as you go to the polls, not just for the ballot proposal, but for the justices, I think you should think carefully about who you vote for.
Well, thank you so much, Deb LaBelle. This has been a real honor for Julie and I to be interviewing you about such important work that you're doing.
Oh, I appreciate it very much, your thoughtful questions and putting this information out there.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. You can get the show on there. You can ask questions. You can email us. We want to hear from you.